So, the four meditations that we were doing just before the break, the purification meditation, very useful when you're in meditation dealing with a problem, but also a very quick way of clearing the mind. Even if you're out and about and you've got to focus on something, very good for that. I think the nine-round breathing is probably, for me and for many people, one of the most effective meditations for calming the mind and focusing your thoughts. It's rare that you do one round of nine, and if that works, fine. But usually, if you do a maximum of two rounds, the difference is quite strong. So if you become used to that type of meditation, learn to hone it to a good level, and also perhaps use the different visualization techniques, because this particular meditation we did on nine round is very simple. It can actually, there's more depth of teaching in that. So if you slowly learn that, it will become even more effective. Extremely useful, especially before meditations on mind. Very effective if you're doing emptiness meditation. And I've also found it extremely effective before bodhicitta meditations. Really helps. And then the other two meditations, dealing with the central channel, they're very quick. Very quick for calming the mind, very quick for wakening the mind up. And I personally find it effective not just in meditation, but also outside of meditation. So please, your feedback on these four, I asked you to make some notes and then to share those experiences. Who would like to feedback? Nori?
Hi, Mary.
Hiya.
Mary, I wondered if you could advise me, because the second meditation you did, I've done it with you before, very successfully, but this time my mind was very excited because I was trying to visualize the breath going down and then, you know, going down from the right and then up to the left and out. Mm-hmm. And by the time I'd done that, I'd breathed about five or six times.
Yeah.
And so I then felt very excited, and so I wonder if you could if you have any advice about that.
It is
a bit slow with things.
It's a busy one. And even though you may have managed it during your retreat perhaps that we were doing, you would have done it a few times and been expecting to do it. However, if you've not done it a lot in between times, and especially if your visualization isn't, you know, you don't have a feeling for the channels inside, it's almost like relearning it.
Right.
But you remember what I said right at the very beginning, learning the Dharma techniques, it's not like ordinary knowledge, it really isn't. It requires us to think in a completely different way. And right. So unless we practice this quite a bit, you keep coming back. This is why they keep talking about beginner's mind. I mean, there is a reason why they say that, but there's a reason why most people in a group will say, oh yeah, I've been doing this 20 years, but really I'm right at the very beginning. They'll say that, you know. And it's because really each time they're doing something, they think to themselves, why can't I do this? Why is it taking me so long? I've heard these teachings a few times. I practiced it a couple of years ago and it was perfect. Now I've lost it. What's going on? You know. And that's just the way of it. You just have to be persistent. And this is why for this one, I didn't make a big thing about watching the breath going down, across and out. It was basically just breathing in and breathing out. Right? So if you do that for a while, just don't follow everything. Simply do as I led you, breathing in and breathing out.
Yeah.
Then, when you get more comfortable with that, then following the breath is helpful. But it's not breathing in, breathing in, breathing in, breathing in, breathing in, breathing out, breathing out, breathing out. It's not like that. It's like this diagram. You know what I mean? But when we do it, we get to go. Like that.
Yes.
So do the way we did it first. Then remember the speed, the pace. It's
okay, thank you.
And it helps just to use the finger and just literally say to yourself, breathing in. Until you get that rhythm. When you do that often enough, then you can enhance it with the light coming in, the dark going into space. When you get used to that, you could start maybe getting a clearer picture of the channel, central channel. Yeah. Blue on the outside, oily red on the inside. And each of the side channels has got a colour. So, but if you teach all of that at once, it's too much. So it's getting used to, incrementally getting used to something that really is a tricky.
Thank you so much. That was very helpful.
Oh, good, Noreen, good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyone else in your discussion, feedbacks and the notes you made? Perhaps you found one meditation easier to do than another or more useful?
Mary, it's Dan. We had a discussion in our group about when we were, I think it cropped up for me, first of all, in expelling past mistakes. But in all of them, so expelling anger energy, I think we all had some experience of getting bogged down in the specifics. So I think, I forget who's...
Rowena
has suggested that she will actually just say anger or past mistakes, which I found really, really helpful, because when I did the past mistakes, I had a massive debate with myself as to whether something truly was a mistake, whether I should have put it in that group. And I sort of wasted a lot of time in sort of thinking, were these really mistakes? I just wonder whether you can give any guidance as to whether we go sort of generic with a concept or how much detail we sink into. I found that a little bit difficult.
First of all, you can give yourself a lot of time if what you're doing is 9-round breathing. You're not using it as a precursor to another meditation. So you're sitting down, you're going to give yourself 15, 20 minutes to do. Then you can spend time. You can pause it in, like when you set up your meditation, you can spend a few minutes actually filling the body with past mistakes in the form of black smoke. Anger issues. I don't think it's that helpful to go into specifics because you get caught up in that. The anger issues. So loading the body, spending a minute or two loading the body with these past mistakes. Acknowledging but not getting caught up in it. Acknowledging those. Very useful. So that when you start the breathing, you know what you're getting rid of. Another way of doing it is to preload your mind. If I'm doing it, for instance, prior to a meditation on mind, then as I'm setting the room up, I'm preloading myself before I sit down. Here is what I'm going to get rid of. I may have a particular issues, so that when I sit down, I've only got a few minutes to do that because my main meditation is perhaps mind. So I either preload it prior to it, but if I'm making it my meditation and I've got, well, why would you give it less than 20 minutes? You know, you've no problem. You would sit down and you'd say, here's what I'm going to do. So you're motivating. And as you're motivating, you're thinking to yourself, I want to free myself from anger. And just see your body filling with black smoke with anger, petty jealousy, judgments, past mistakes, and just load the body. Just load it. Black smoke. And then when you start the breathing, away it goes. Yeah.
That's very helpful. Yes.
John, you're welcome. Thank you. You're welcome.
Hi there, Mary.
Hi, Shay.
Mary, hello. Sorry, I jumped in a bit late, so I don't know if these questions were asked already. I have two questions, and that's okay. One about the colour of the channels. I think you're mentioning and I've forgotten what colours they are, and I spend a lot of the meditation trying switching between red and white because I can't remember which one is which. So you can remind us what the colours of the channels are. I think the central one is blue, right? Light blue.
Blue on the outside, and a kind of oily red on the inside.
Okay.
And the right channel, red, left, white.
Red and white, okay, all right. And the other question, thank you, I'll write that down. The other question I had as well was that the two last ones that we did were the seed of mind down below your navel. I'd misunderstood, or I'd learned, I guess, that the mind was sort of in the kind of this area, sort of the chest area.
Yes.
So I was a bit confused in terms of where the mind sits within the body.
This horse is way. Oh, God. Everything's changed now. Why has everything changed? I'm so sorry. Just give me one second, see if I can get into gallery view again. Okay. All right. So the seat of the mind, in the central channel here. That's true. But the mind travels all around the body. Okay. Wherever you're aware, there's your mind. And that becomes very interesting when you become aware of things outside your body. The mind isn't a lump. This is what we've got to get our head. It's not a lump of thing. It's really spacious, and it's pure awareness. That's its function, simply to be aware. Its nature is clarity and knowing. There's no thingness about the mind. But when you're doing meditations, yes, here you tend to think of the seat of your mind at your heart, but you move it all around your body. Now, there is particular advantages in different chakras, to place the mind in different areas in the chakras, it gives you different advantages. And one of the advantages of bringing the mind down to the navel area just below is calmness. And so bringing it down to four finger widths below the navel and then entering the seat, that's your mind. To be aware of that, what you're trying to do is bring, at the moment there's a separate, here I am looking at my mind. Here I am looking at my mind. So it's bringing it down until you are there. You've penetrated the seat, the mind is the seat, that's it. And because of that, and because of the area of the body has particular advantages to calming the mind, that's why it's useful. But the mind is not stuck anywhere. The things that stay there is the indestructible. Do you do tantra at all?
No.
No. Okay, well. Yeah. So really, it's so mobile. It's so mobile. So never worry about that. There'll be some meditations in tantra, you'll be moving it up and down and across. And not to worry. So that it's very good that way. But imagine on the second meditation where you shoot your mind all the way through the crown of the head into deep space, you become one with space. Where's your mind then?
Yeah, I think those of I think in our group we said it was quite a trippy experience shooting our minds out into space.
But its purpose is to wake you up. Vastness. It's to wake you up, have the vastness, and if you're there. And you can stay there for as long as you like, depending on what meditation you're doing. And any thought, idea, or emotion, they just disappear in the vastness of space. There's nothing for it to have purchase on. There's nothing to go, oh, that's an interesting thought. I wonder about this. Nothing like that. It comes up. But because your mind's in the vastness of space, there's nothing for it to purchase. It just disappears. Mm. It's very useful.
Yeah. Found that one very effective, very, very effective. And I think even when you were sort of carrying on, I think I just completely blanked it out.
Well, I was watching a few people and they didn't want to come out of that at all. That's what I saw. I saw people sitting there and twitching when I said anything. You know. Thank you, Sharon. Right.
Thank you, Mary.
Anyone else?
Hi, Mary, Zoe.
Zoe, hi.
Hi. I wondered about, you know, when we're doing the black smoke, where you feel it's better to expel it from, because we were taught, I was explaining in our group that when I was doing the meditation of getting rid of the black smoke, even though you said a few times, actually, once it's left, it's not coming back, don't worry, it's kind of gone. But I felt that on the next inhale, I was bringing a bit of black smoke back in. So I wondered if it's probably, we discussed in the group, it's probably better to have the smoke, the white light coming in here and the black smoke going out of one of the lower orifices so that you don't...
Not for this meditation. I understand. No, I do understand. But not for this meditation.
Okay.
The benefit of this meditation, you really are breathing in and breathing out the negativities. There might be some meditations where they might alter that, but not the nine round breathing, no. So when I first started, when I was first taught this many years ago, this nine round breathing, I had a lot of difficulty. Here was my difficulty. The black smoke, no problem. All my difficulties, no problem. Here was my problem. As I breathed out, it seemed to surround me. It didn't go anywhere. You know, I'm thinking, oh my God. My difficulty was, as I breathed out, to send it into deep space quickly, like a shot of a gun, a narrow coming out. Because when I breathe out black smoke, because we can see black smoke around, when you see people burning fires or images on the television, smoke hangs about, right? And so when you're doing this meditation, if you've got an imprint of smoke hanging about, then it's tricky when you breathe back in again. So when you do this, really energize, when you breathe out, it's black smoke streaming away, but it just goes deep into space, disappears quickly. Just go. And so with your breath in, the light of the Buddha, the light of the blessings of your teacher, universal energy, whatever you think, there's no problem then.
Okay.
But certainly when I first started, that was my main problem, because every time I thought, when I breathed out, the smoke went out, but it seemed to hang about. It never went anywhere.
So that was what was happening.
But yeah, I had to really practice.
It didn't happen to me with the nine round breathing. It was the first one that you did about this black smoke leaving
purification.
The body.
Yeah. It's because we have an imprinted memory of smoke. Everybody's seen smoke from on the television and outside. And what does smoke do? Smoke doesn't like this, it hangs about. And of course, that's what we bring into this meditation. We don't mean to, but we do bring it in. And so you identify that as a problem and you practice. When you breathe, you see the smoke, but it's a bit like a rocket. You know how these rockets go, whoosh, it's like whoosh, deep space. And somebody goes, did you see that? No, I missed it. That fast.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Anyone else?
Venerable Mary, it's Rowena. Could I ask a question?
Yeah, Rowena.
So I had trouble keeping my seed very small.
Yes.
And I had trouble keeping my channels straw sort of size. So my channels seem to get about the size of a penny in circumference. And the seed, when I was focusing on it, seemed to get bigger and bigger. And no problem, wash out into the universe. And the size of the seed got smaller then. But when I was focusing on it, it was getting increasingly, it went from a sesame seed to a big pumpkin seed or something, you know.
That can happen. Yeah, that can happen. And I have to say, my visualizations are not that great, so I tend to use imagination. I use visualization in this, but my imagination is kind of, my visualization is at this level, but my imagination's at this level. So I just keep imagining it's very small. The other thing I used to do when my vision, when I was trying very hard with visualizations and I couldn't get it very small, I made myself very big. So in proportion, the seed was very small. But at the moment, I tend to think of, I've done it for years, but you know a coffee bean? It's quite big. But you know it's got that line through it. I find that very easy to think, you know, red and white. Because it's, and then I shrink it. And I find that very good. It helped me a lot. For someone like myself that's not so good at visualization. But remember, imagination is very powerful.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going big, making myself big. I think that will help a lot, actually.
Just try it. Okay. See how it works. But in the end, the more you practice, the smaller it becomes.
Okay, thank you.
And even if you're thinking about it, and you think it's the side of a pumpkin seed, don't think of it like that. Think of it, oh, it's a sesame seed. I'm just using magnifying glass. You're welcome. Anyone else? Yes, Lynn.
I'm just curious, having heard that last question from Rowena, I hadn't thought about it before, but I think my channels and my seed were probably bigger. What's the significance of the size? I mean, does it matter if it's bigger or? Might be a silly question.
Well, I don't want to go into it too much because it really goes into the tantric bit, but really all these teachings come from yogic practitioners and most of the teaching from Tantra, really. So these descriptions come from yogic practitioners. Mm-hmm. And so they're saying this is the best way. So I don't investigate that anymore because I mean, it's worth investigating, please feel free. But for me, I tend to, because I've seen the nervous system exposed and I've seen the lymph system exposed, it's not so difficult for me to think of another system within the body, which is a tantric vessels, you know, psychic vessels going. So to me, that's not so difficult. And the thing about saying a sesame seed is because if you take a sesame seed and you put it in a small straw, it still has space around it. So that gives you an idea of the width. But I play about with it quite a bit, I have to say.
That's fine. Thanks very much, Mary. Well, I was just curious.
I understand. Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else come out of your discussion? No. Okay, so let's think. If we think placement meditation really highly depends on analytical meditation. If you're within, and analytical meditation relies on spiritual instructions on the path. So placement meditation depending upon analytical meditation really dependent upon instructions, listening to teachings time and time again, study, reflection, meditating. That's how it works. The Lamrim is extensive in the Galupa, but all four schools have some form of Lamrim. I mean, the card, you have what they call the four thoughts that turn the mind. And those are four areas of Lamrim. So there it's precious human rebirth, it's death and impermanence, it's karma and suffering. So all four schools employ Lamrim, but nowhere is it employed in depth as it is in the Galupa. And so to me, if stabilizing depends on analytical and analytical depends on spiritual instructions, then choosing a structure that's clear and in depth and easy to practice is important. So what we're looking at now is shamatha. So when the Buddha said, or not the Buddha, but when it's said that there are two types of meditation, really, when they talk about concentration, when the Buddha talked about concentration, he was talking about shamatha. He was talking about shamatha. And I know I said this at the beginning, but remember, there is a difference between focused meditation, or called placement or stability, What that is it's a placement meditation. It's using some of the skills necessary in developing shamatha, but it's not shamatha. When you take teachings on shamatha, what you're taking teachings on is a distinct set of teachings, a distinct path of attentional development, developing your attention. At the end of that path, you aim to develop samadhi, this meditative power, which has physical benefits, it has psychic benefits, that you have the ability to focus for hours on end, to really penetrate the object. Your mind is unwavering. So you really are looking at a path separate from anything else, but useful in other types of meditation. The greatest Sangha, he said, really what shamatha is about is non-forgetfulness of the mind with respect to a chosen object. Non-forgetfulness of the mind with respect to a familiar object. And he finished his discussion by saying, really what this is non-distraction. And it's developed in many countries. How you develop it is you choose an object. You choose an object. It could be an object external to yourself, such as maybe you want to start having a stability meditation on the Buddha. So you might start focusing on a particular image of the Buddha externally and then create that visually in your mind. Because shamatha is developed upon a mental object, not a physical object. But certain teachings teach you to look at an external object, create a mental picture, and then the mental picture is your focus. So if you're looking for a definition of shamatha, it's good to be clear. It's non-forgetfulness of the object. The ability to choose one object and develop your mind to such a way that you can focus on this mental object for as long as you wish. For as long as you wish. Now, today, and in the 8th century, there was confusion here. You had schools of Buddhists who said developing shamatha is really not necessary. Really what you should be doing is studying vipassana, practicing vipassana, and from that you gain sudden insight. And that is enough for liberation. So in the 8th century in Tibet, there was a teacher called, I think it's Mohayen, from the Chen school, had a lot of followers in Tibet. And he taught this sudden insight, this sudden awakening. He was the main advocate. The king at the time, a Dharma king called Trizan Detsen, wasn't sure about this at all, because he was aware there were other teachings from India, particularly Nalanda monastery, who were saying that really what you need to do is sudden insight. While it's kind of can give you some encouragement, it doesn't last. And for enlightenment, liberation, enlightenment, you need more than sudden insight. You need to develop your mind to such a state that any penetrating focus is sustainable. And so what King Trizan Detsen did is he held a debate in Tibet, where he brought the Chan Buddhist, Mohayan, and all his followers were there. And one of the top scholars from Nalanda Monastery, who advocated shamatha, attention development, shamatha, based on the teachings of the great Nagarjuna. And they had a debate. Now, at this time, when you had a debate, it wasn't all friendly. And it could last for weeks. There was a lot at stake, when you had Tibet, when you in Tibet and in India, when you had a proper debate, the loser lost everything. They were exiled. Their teachings were abandoned in that particular country. And the followers were forced, almost, unless they left the country, to convert to the winner's side. Debate was not a nicey-nicey thing. Okay? It was very, very, it was hard, and the consequences were strong. You needed to win this. So they had this debate in the 8th century in Tibet. Depending on which text you read, it went on for a few weeks. So sudden insight did have a lot going for it, but there's no way it could overcome Kamala Shila's development through the great Nagarjuna's teaching. Everything he brought up, everything he argued with could not be overcome. Whereas eventually, this sudden insight could be overcome. And the Chan Buddhism lost. The teacher and his students were exiled. Those who remained came over to Kamala Shila. That was the result. They came over to Kamala Shila. Why is that important? It's important because even today, especially with the modern Vipassana movement and with secular Vipassana, there is a big school of thought that says what's needed is mindfulness, not shamatha. It's mindfulness. And in the modern Vipassana movement, they define mindfulness as moment-to-moment non-judgmental awareness. And there is nothing wrong with that. The modern Vipassana movement does lots of benefit. It can help people very much in this lifetime. It's helped so many people. But it's not what the Buddha taught. It's a variation on what the Buddha taught. The faculty of mindfulness, which is so crucial in Vipassana, is developed in shamatha. And the definition from it that the Buddha taught had a strong element of non-forgetfulness. The ability to hold and don't forget the object. You're able to hold that object in your mind. With shamatha, you have to be able to attend continuously to a familiar object without distraction, without forgetting the object. That's the whole difference. And so when people say they're teaching mindfulness, if it's mindfulness within the Buddhist tradition, that's what they mean. Mindfulness that's crucial, but it's developed in shamatha, non-forgetfulness of the object. If you're doing a mindfulness course, and it's a modern Vipassana movement, which often is Buddhist, they'll say they're Buddhist, often it's secular, you need to find out what their definition is. If it's moment-to-moment, non-judgmental awareness, then that's not what the Buddha taught. However, it's beneficial. Helps people, absolutely. But they're talking mindfulness, 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 and you can be swayed to thinking that's what the Buddha meant by mindfulness, but it's not. Is there anyone here who has done a mindfulness course, a secular mindfulness course? Lynn? Useful?
Yes, it was, but I actually teach mindfulness.
Excellent.
So I teach 8-week courses, but I do mentally see the two as being separate. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't personally taught that mindfulness was Buddhist, although I was taught that it had roots in Buddhism.
Yes.
But one of the reasons I became more interested in Buddhism was because I wanted to understand
yes.
what differences were and where mindfulness came from.
That's
but I do think secular mindfulness is very useful in helping people to manage their well-being.
Definitely.
And, you know, for that reason, that was why I decided to go into teaching it, because it was very useful for me.
It's useful, and it reaches a wide variety of people. Yeah. Everybody's interested in it, and it's fantastic. There is nothing wrong with that, really. Sometimes I talk like this and people say, oh, Mary doesn't like sex. That's not true. Mm. But what I get is I get people coming in courses with me and talking about mindfulness, and they cannot move their mind away from the modern Vipassana movement. They cannot move their mind away from the secular understanding, and will say to me in class quite clearly, that's not mindfulness. Mindfulness is this, this, and this. And I have to be very patient and say, well, like, you know, you're right if your focus is secular mindfulness. You're extremely correct if you're looking at the modern Vipassana. But this is not what the Buddha meant for mindfulness. And it's not the mindfulness that's needed to develop the mind to such a level that you can apply it in Vipassana. So even today, you'll have quite a variety of people who say, Shamatha, yeah, well, you know, maybe not necessary. Vipassana is the thing. Vipassana is the thing. Of course, Vipassana is the thing. But if you haven't sharpened your mind with Shamatha, you'll get its insights, but you won't get stability. That's the difference. This is straight from Kamala Shila, and his teachings are straight from the great Nagarjuna. So as long as you know what you're letting yourself in for, that's fine. But you can't apply mindfulness that you learn in the modern Vipassana and then expect it to have lasting beneficial results in Vipassana as taught by Nagarjuna. That's really the thing. So, please be clear, both are good, but be clear with Shamatha. If you're developing Shamatha, mindfulness is very clear. It is not moment to moment, non-judgmental awareness, being in the present. It's got nothing to do with that. It's about allowing your mind to settle and hold a particular object that you've chosen without distraction for hours on end. That's what you're aiming for. Okay? Any questions about that? It's looking quite quiet. Okay. So if you have the contents page of the Lam Rim, maybe have a look at it and see where Shamatha sits in the list. So if you have it in front of you, you'll see that Shamatha, sometimes called calm abiding meditation, rests in the great scope, the great capable being. Number 16, Shamatha, calm abiding meditation. Now it's abiding there. Why? It's highlighted, I can't see a thing. Can we maybe take that off the screen now? Thank you. Why is it abiding there? It's abiding there because at this stage, the motivation for a person of great capability is the motivation for this, if you remember, is someone who is not happy about is not aiming for a better life next time round. It's not, this person's not aiming to come off the wheel of suffering. This person wants liberation and enlightenment, not just for themselves, but all living beings without exception. That's what they're aiming for. Now, for anything that depth, Shamatha is essential. And it's in the great being, because what else is there? Generating bodhicitta. What else is there? Emptiness, the nature of reality. And so if you see all of Buddha's teachings in a lump, one third of the lump will be ethics, morality, calming the mind. It's all about calming the mind. And once the mind is calm, the second lump of all the Buddha's teaching is about how to develop concentration. And when you've developed concentration to a very high level with shamatha, the last lump is wisdom. So you have a mind now that has been calmed by ethics, has been sharpened by shamatha, and you put in front of that the nature of reality, and it penetrates it. That's why it sits in the great scope. Now, you start developing shamatha, but even in the early stages, you'll start to acquire a more stable mind. And because you're acquiring a more stable mind, you're able to put it into practice when you're doing small scope teachings, medium scope teachings. So as you develop even stage one and stage two of shamatha, you're acquiring skills which are immediately beneficial when you do analytical and single-pointed concentration, analytical and placement meditations. But it sits, it nestles in the great being, the great capable being, because it's without this, there is no shamatha, there is no penetrating the nature of reality to a level that leads to enlightenment. There's no developing, well, there is a debate still going on, but the majority of that debate says that even to develop the highest level of bodhicitta, you need shamatha. But that is slightly debated. So that's why it nestles there. But even people beginning to learn how to do it, you acquire attentional skills that will help you in your stability meditations that come out of analytical. And I can't emphasize this strongly enough. If you can develop a practice that includes building up your attention, so you're doing a lot of analytical, especially in the beginning, that's highly important, it's more important. But if you could tag on to that sometimes, developing shamatha, then together it's perfect. It's a perfect practice.
Then Mary, can I just ask a question?
Of course.
I just wondered where we can learn shamatha as a you know, specific thing, because I don't think I've ever seen a shamatha course on Land of Joy.
No. No. Well, over the years, getting teachings on shamatha has been rare. It's been rare. And there's lots of kind of reasons for that. I don't think they hold water, but there were reasons. Because if you look at your contents page, every one of those contents lists is well taught, except shamatha. And there are reasons for that. Maybe not good to go into it here, but there are reasons. However, about... Wendy might correct me, but I think about 10 or 11 years ago, His Holiness the Dalai Lama started talking about shamatha. He started to emphasize the importance of shamatha. And then from then on, you started to see the odd course coming up, okay? Certainly in Leeds, Geshe Tashe, for a few years was doing a yearly shamatha retreat. There's actually politics concerned here, but there's also assumptions. Within the Tibetan tradition, they value certain things. They value, although there's a smorgasbord of what you can do, they value sitting meditation over anything else. In developing shamatha, they often value shamatha being a result of some tantric practices. They also value, if you learn shamatha, to learn to concentrate on an image of the Buddha or the image of a seed syllable. But visualization is highly valued within the Tibetan system. Tibetans have very little problem with visualization. In the West, it seems that we're not so good at it. Now, you can develop shamatha on objects that require no visualization. This has been taught throughout the centuries of Buddhism, heavily taught in the Nyingma tradition and in the Kagyu tradition. That means that you can develop, the object you choose could be compassion. The object you choose could be emptiness. You'd have to really know what you were doing, but you could choose that. Or the object can be something as straightforward as the sensation of the breath. One of the most, one of the best people to teach this is Lama Alan Wallace. Lama Alan Wallace has spent many, many years teaching shamatha to Westerners in particular. He had great difficulty developing shamatha on a visualized object, great difficulty. And so he, having spoken to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, having read the Nyingma teachings and the Kagyu teachings, realized that there was, he could easily, not easily, but he could quite quickly start to develop shamatha on the breath. So he looked into it quite deeply and he said, there's three objects which are particularly useful to Western mind. The first object is the sensation of the breath. You can use that as your object and with some slight changes, but you can use it all the way through to achieve shamatha. There is some things you have to learn to do, but still. So he teaches that, and he teaches it extremely well. I personally have never met anyone. I've had shamatha teachings from a variety, and I've read widely. And those books that only really emphasize a visualized object, I find quite difficult. Very busy. Very, I couldn't do it. I tried. But Alan encouraged us to look at the breath and develop on the breath. The second object, he says, is very useful in developing is the mind itself, the mind and its contents. And the third object is called awareness of awareness. And he said, these for the Western mind, he thinks, is perfect. It's just perfect. Because if you're living, you're breathing. So you have no problem with that. You don't have to visualize the breath. You're fine. If you're living, your mind is working. So your mind is always there. And there's always stuff in your mind. So you can become aware of your mind and the objects in the mind. If you're living and breathing, you're aware. And so awareness is always with you. These three objects, he teaches. You can do all three at different times, or you can choose one to take you all the way through to shamatha. His book is called The Attention Revolution. The Attention Revolution. It's a small book. I don't know if you can see. It's a small book. You can see my one of my favorite topics, The Attention Revolution. It's not a big book, and it's probably the clearest book I've ever read on developing shamatha. And I tell you this, I have read many. But because these three objects don't require visualization, they don't require the mental energy that's needed to be employed in order to create and maintain a visualization. And remember, you've got to be able to create a visualization, maintain it before you focus on it. And when you're mentally visualizing something, if you're using that as an object, say like the Buddha, it would have to be a certain size, it would have to be 3D. And it's not solid. So a lot of what you have to learn to do is about creating the image, sustaining the image, what to do when the image fails. So it's a very, very busy mind. And for me, I just give me a headache. But once I had some teaching from Lama Alan, the next thing I thought is this just Lama Alan? I've been doing this 30 odd years. I've never heard of this. But it's because I hadn't read widely. I'd stuck to a certain group and I hadn't read widely. Then I started reading. The lineage for these three objects goes all the way back to the Buddha. The great Nagarjuna taught it. Guru Rinpoche emphasized it. And so the lineage of these teachings are perfect. And so that gave me confidence to start practicing. And I find it very beneficial.
Mm. Very Thank beneficial. You.
But there are more. I'm not saying just that. I mean, I only teach that, these three, simply because I'm not teaching something that I can't do myself. Do you want to do something about it myself? So the other ways I don't teach because I can't do them. So.
Okay, thank you very much, Mary.
You're welcome. Anything else about that? Yeah, Mary?
Yeah, I was just, can you hear me?
I can.
Yes, there's, at the moment, Glenn Svensson is doing the course in Copenhagen on Shamanta. So I was just thinking the previous person who was asking about it. We've done 2 weekends now. There's 5 weekends in total. And you can get the recordings.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I highly recommend it. I mean, Lama Alan Wallace and Glenn Svensson, these are the two. I personally, I go nowhere else. That's where I go. Because it's clean, clear. And Glenn Svensson is an excellent teacher. He has so much resources online that if you really want to learn, it's clean, clear, clean, clear. Stuart?
Is it appropriate for me to mention, Mary, that from next Monday you're teaching on Shamatha with the Liverpool group?
Yes. Okay, so I've taught for four previous Mondays, Shamatha, going into kind of detail about Shamatha itself, and also focusing as the breath is the object. The next 4 weeks, starting next Monday, I'm doing another 4 evenings, and in that I'm focusing on mind and its content as the object, how to do this with the mind and its contents as an object. And awareness of awareness as the object. So it's a continuation for the first set of 4 weeks I did, which was generally about Shamatha and concentrating on the breath. The next 4 weeks, not so much general, but literally just doing the work and choosing the object will be mind and its content. How do you do this? How do you know you're there? You know? Simple, straightforward stuff and awareness of awareness. That's the object. So that's what I'm covering for the next 4 weeks. That's what they want me to do in Liverpool. And I've been requested for the Beamsley retreat in November. November the 6th through to the 8th. I'm doing that online. And that's Shamatha. I'm spending a full weekend teaching Shamatha on these three objects, doing the generally about it and then doing the practice in the hope that you can choose one or two of these objects and just go for it. Yeah. That's my hope. Yeah, thank you. Anything else? I'm just keeping an eye on the time. So you could say, really, that Shamatha develops the mind, sharpens the mind to the highest extent. And then Vipassana that I'm going to go into, Vipassana, it's applied in Vipassana. It's applied. The thing about Shamatha is that it's one of the things, it's not a Buddhist practice. Okay, it's not a Buddhist practice. It was around long before the Buddha. It was developed by, in Hindu religion, the Brahmins in particular, wandering aesthetics, the sadhus, this was their main practice. Developing higher and higher levels of samadhi. The Buddha, in fact, developed when he was studying with practitioners, the sadhus, he developed one of the highest levels of shamatha. But he realized that, yes, with certain levels of shamatha, you get psychic powers, physical powers, but you're still within the wheel of suffering. There's no way there's freedom here. There's no freedom in shamatha. Only if you apply it. And that's what the Buddha did. When the Buddha had done all the aesthetic practices and things like this, and he realized, yes, I've developed, but I'm still in suffering. I'm not free. He remembered a time when he was a child in his father's field, and he sat down very quietly and almost slipped into samadhi, very high level of shamatha. And when he thought that, there was a great change came in the Buddha. And when he decided to sit under the Bodhi tree and not get up until he was enlightened, this is what he did. This was the goal of the Buddha. This was the great innovation that the Buddha brought. This is what started really Dharma. What he did is, because he had shamatha, he then used it. He purposely applied it to the nature of reality. He used shamatha to cultivate special insight as Vipassana. The great innovation was his fusion of shamatha and Vipassana. This process of inquiry, that's what Vipassana is. It's a process of inquiry, directing the sharp mind to your own inner experiences so that you see your inner experiences for what they clearly are. You become aware of what is happening as it happens. It's the oldest Buddhist meditational practice, Vipassana. It comes not from Vajrayana, it comes from the sutras, the actual words of the Buddha, in the foundation of mindfulness. And it's all about cultivating mindful awareness. With the sharp mind of shamatha, you're looking at aspects of your own existence, deeper and deeper and more, as your experiences of this life flower, you see it for what it is. It's a question, Vipassana is a questioning approach. It's looking at questions such as all your experience of the body, the mind, all of phenomena, all your experiences, and it's looking at them, and as they arise, with the sharpness of shamatha penetrating into the question of Vipassana, you're asking questions such as permanence or impermanence and seeing it clearly. The question, is this satisfactory or unsatisfactory? Penetrating it, seeing it clearly. This experience, does it have a self? Is it solid and unchanging, or is it selfless? The sharp mind of shamatha, seeing it clearly. And so within Buddhist tradition, the levels of Vipassana practice are often through a way called the four applications of mindfulness. That's one way of, there's many ways of developing shamatha. In our tradition, it tends to be very much relying on the four close applications of mindfulness. And you apply that to the body, the mind, mental events, and all phenomena. This is not a quiet mind. It's using the sharpness of mind that you've developed through a quiet mind, but it's a questioning mind. It's asking questions such as, what is the original of all this that's happening? What's its causal efficacy? Does it dissolve into nothingness? If so, what? And each domain of experience this is applied to. This is Vipassana. putting it in context, our meditation is really based on our increasing understanding and experience of Lam Rim topics. Ground yourself in that. Small scope, medium scope, large scope teachings. Finally, develop your mind through shamatha. Then apply it to what's important, nature, reality. Often in the text, they say when you apply shamatha and you start questioning shamatha, they talk about the three marks of existence. Because this is what it's about. Do things exist the way we think they exist? And so vipassana is really getting down to the nub of it. The three marks of existence are permanence or impermanence, satisfactory or unsatisfactory, self or no self. So that's how it fits. So please take a moment to stretch. Move about, take a sip. How are we doing? Are we all back? No. Okay, Dan and Noreen, I see your thumb. Thank you. Welcome back, Carlo Rina. Okay, maybe good to start. Oh, Merv, good. So please arrange your posture. We're going to do a meditation. My feeling is if you've not done a meditation lying down in the corpse position, if you're able to do so, I would highly recommend, particularly for this one, to get yourself in a very relaxed supine position. No falling asleep, okay. We don't have that long to go. Okay. Get yourself comfortable. Now, a preamble to this meditation is the understanding of the importance of relaxation. If you think you've relaxed during this retreat, doing relaxation, it's really just a starter. You have to develop, it's best to develop the strongest relaxation you can. Your ultimate goal of relaxation is having a body that's almost asleep and a mind that's sharp and clear. That's the balance that's needed. And so relaxing is very, very important. On the next thing that's important is a stability of attention. The problem with relaxation is if your mind gets dull and sleepy, then stability of attention is too hard to develop. So on the basis of your ability to relax, you develop a stability of attention. Based on your ability to relax, stability of attention, you have vividness. And these three together are crucial. Relaxation, stability of attention, and vividness. This in turn needs a bedrock of even deeper relaxation. You can never relax enough. So deeper relaxation, a stillness. Once you've relaxed into things and you're into your meditation, there's a point really where you want to say to yourself, be still. Don't move anymore. Keep it light. If you have to move, you have to move. But generally speaking, try to keep still. And you imbue all of that with strong vigilance. So relaxation, stability of attention, and vividness is on the bedrock of even deeper relaxation. Stillness of body and vigilance of mind. So settling your body, check your posture. Quickly bring to mind strong positive motivation. Now begin by allowing your consciousness to sink downwards to help you sink your consciousness, release deeply and relax the body on the out breath, keeping your sternum slightly elevated. Become fully aware where your body contacts the earth, where the body contacts the chair, or where one part of your body is touching another. That's what you flood your mind with. That's what you now become aware, allowing your consciousness to sink. Helping you do this on the out-breath. Allowing your mind to be aware of where your body is contacting anything solid. Where one part of your body is touching another part. Become fully aware. Scan the body. Release any tension on the out-breath. Pay special attention to the face and the brow. Continuing to breathe easily, naturally, releasing the tension on the out-breath. Have the eyes as you wish, open, closed, half open, whatever is comfortable. Your attitude is of ease and vigilance. Be very vigilant. Know what you're doing. If you're lying down, vigilance is increased by you mentally saying to yourself, this is a formal meditation posture. This is not a restful posture. Starting from the feet, all the way to the crown, begin to notice any tactile sensations from your feet through your body to the crown, and just release these sensations on the out-breath. Note them, release them. And from this moment, try to avoid all movement. In a moment, take a breath that fills the belly first and slowly fills up to the top of the chest. Then release and then breathe naturally in your own time. In a moment, you will take three separate breaths. Each time, you breathe through your nostrils. And as you breathe in, let awareness permeate your entire body, noting the sensations related to the breath. You do this three times. So once more, you take a deep breath through your nostrils. And as you breathe in, let awareness penetrate your entire body. Simply note the sensations in relation to the breath. Do this three times and then breathe normally. And now allowing your respirations to flow in its own natural rhythm. Don't impose rhythm. Don't influence your breath. Don't have a preference. Simply stay with the natural flow. And in this natural flow, simply note the sensations of the respirations wherever they arise in the body. Noting if your breath is long or short, deep or shallow, fast or slow, just a mental note, nothing more. Your body as if it is fast asleep, but the mind is highly vigilant. Thoughts, ideas, emotions, very natural. Recognize them. Don't involve yourself with them. Just let them go. Relax and release them on the out-breath. There's no suppression here. Note, relax, release on the out-breath. Again and again, counteract any difficulty by relaxing more deeply on the out-breath. That's the only thing you do. Relax deeply on the out-breath. And instead of sucking the in-breath in, allow the in-breath to flow into you effortlessly, like an incoming tide. Here's the balance we have to achieve. Maintaining whatever level of relaxation you have, maintaining that, we now develop stability. So we lower our awareness to the movement of the abdomen with the breath. Become fully aware of the movement of the abdomen with the breath. You're fully aware of the expanding and the contracting, the beginning of the movement, how long the movement lasts, any pauses, you're totally there. If it's helpful, you can count at the beginning of each inhalation, a very quick staccato count. So mentally, 1, 2, all the way to 10, and then back to 1. That may help you stay there. As before, on the out-breath, release any involuntary thoughts. Continue with your meditation, being fully aware of the movement of the abdomen with the breath. If your mind becomes dull, simply arouse your attention and refocus. If your mind is bothered by excitation, simply relax more deeply. How do you do this? You arouse your attention on the in-breath. You focus. You relax on the out-breath. So try that simply for 5 minutes, being with the movement of the abdomen, releasing involuntary thoughts on the out-breath, counteracting sleepiness with arousing your attention on the in-breath, counteracting excitation by relaxing more deeply on the out-breath for 5 minutes. So consider that this type of meditation is a balancing act between attention and relaxation. The point is not to stop thoughts arising. It is to, first of all, relax the body, and second, cultivate stability of attention. The next step is to increase your vividness. And this is cultivated by elevating your focus of attention. So elevate your focus of attention from the abdomen upwards towards the nostrils. Direct your attention to the tactile sensations of the nostrils or upper lip with the breath, wherever the breath is felt. Your attention is constantly there. There is an ongoing flow of sensation. Be aware of the beginning, middle, end, pauses. Really be with the sensation of the breath. Counting may help you. At the beginning of each breath, quickly count one. And count the breaths till 10, and then go back to one. But that's only to help you anchor your mind where you feel the sensation of the breath at the nostrils or upper lip. As before, release any involuntary thoughts on the out-breath. If the problem is dullness, arouse your attention on the in-breath and just refocus. If the problem is dullness, relax more deeply on the out-breath. I'm getting tired, that's wrong. So if your problem is dullness, arouse your attention on the in-breath. If your problem is excitation, relax on the out-breath. So it's the same thing. Count if it helps for the next 5 minutes. And as this meditation comes to an end, bring to mind the fact that when you're cultivating the vivid aspect, other sensations in the body and mind are a natural consequence of the practice. Simply let them be, don't engage. Let them go on the out-breath. Develop the quality of introspection, that ability to note quite quickly whether the mind is dulling or becoming too excited. You're really developing balanced attention here, and it has a very healing effect. This healing effect comes from the natural balance of the mind, not the object, but from the mind. One of the earliest challenges with this type of meditation is as the mind calms, respirations appear to become shallower and more subtle. When this happens, you just increase your attention, refocus. And so remembering your motivation, begin to gather the energy that you've created and direct it towards achieving your goal, dedicate it. And if you're lying down, as you end the meditation, turn your palms facing downwards. It's a sort of physical manifestation that you've changed your mind. You're now out of meditation. So turn your palms the opposite way down. It's a sort of body arch. It sort of says, now my meditation is ended. And as you open your eyes gently, without moving too much, taking your surroundings, how do they look to you? And then in your own time, just join us again. So, no group work. But if anyone would like to say how that meditation went for them, it went well or badly, difficult, not difficult, fell asleep when I was lying down, I don't know. Any comments? Yes.
During the first 5 minutes, I felt like a bomb wanting to explode.
All right.
But I was like, no, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to. And then I had a major, major hot flush. I thought, no, I'm not going to react to it. I'm just going to let it go. And it did. It finished. Finished quite quickly. I just noted its impermanence and carried on with the stability, but I couldn't manage it the second time. In the second 5 minutes, I did end up moving, but that urge to move, seriously, it's just oh.
So this is an exercise that we would do prior to focusing on the object. And if you start doing this type of meditation, I mean, in a 24-minute session, sometimes 20 minutes is spent on relaxing and stabilizing vividness. And your bell goes and you've not focused on your object. So it's only practice. And the more you practice, the easier and the sooner comes the deep relaxation. You're not going for perfection. You're going for as much as you can manage during that session. Mm-hmm. And then quickly onto the stability and the vividness. And as time goes on, that takes less time. It takes less time. But then sometimes it'll be easier than others. You never know. You never know. Thank you. Anyone else?
Mary, it's Rowena.
Hiya.
Right. At the end of the meditation, you said to put your palms downwards. Mm. I didn't realise I should have had them up because I had them down all the whole time.
It's not a problem. It's just what's recommended for doing this particular practice is that, and you should look up for the supine position on the way. See the pictures when you're lying down. So the hands are lying like that, okay. Either side of your body, close but not touching. And then when you've finished, you turn. This is highly recommended by Lama Alan, because otherwise what happens is you tend to drift into meditation and you drift out. And so by bodily moving in a certain way, it kind of clicks with the mind. It's particularly useful if you're doing this meditation in the evening and you're lying on your bed. The tendency is you're doing the meditation, you're feeling great, and you drift off to sleep. So this is not a good habit to get into. And so Lama Alan highly recommends that you do something. So if you're lying on the floor, that's the easiest thing you're doing. If you're on your bed, it may be that you shift your position to your side if you're a side sleeper, but you do something that ends the meditation. You don't drift out.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyone else? Thank you. Well, I think really, I want to thank all of you for attending, and you know, your participation has been excellent. You've made my teaching so easy for me when people are happy and in doing the practice. So I want to thank you all for turning up and helping me out. It's been really a joy to share the Dharma with you. Really a joy. And when we participate in discussion, we share our own Dharma with other people, and that's helpful. I want to particularly thank Wendy for facilitating this, really. She's made it very easy for all of us. And for Faye, for helping Wendy and for learning how to do this so that in the future we can have more of these sessions. I highly wish that you, check out an organization. If you're not belong to a meditation or a Buddhist organization near you and you want to study, I highly recommend you do that. Find out. Whatever group you choose, please investigate them thoroughly. There are some strange people out there. When you're learning to meditate and you're learning the Dharma, you're dealing with your mind. Don't put that in the hands of strange people. That's all I'm saying. So check. This organization is called the FPMT. Check that out. See how you feel about that. Check the courses. But if you align yourself with a group or you start attending a center, it will be so much easier for you to learn and to practice with like-minded people. So I really highly recommend that. Thank you very much.
Mary, on behalf of everybody here, so I hope you accept this offering.
Virtual scout. Okay.
And the virtual kata here. So on behalf of us all, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, sharing your experience, and doing it in such an experiential, interactive way. So we hope you live a really, really long life, Mary, and carry on, you know, sharing your wisdom with us all. And yeah, I hope you'll do this, you know, further courses for Land of Joy. And I know if you go on FPMT sites, the UK one, if you go on Jamyang Leeds or if you go on Jamyang London, they have a joint calendar telling you all about the online courses in Liverpool and in Saraswati Centre and in Leeds and in London. So the courses Ven Mary's mentioned, the online Shamatha course, Lynn's already said, you know, just email her for more information. But if you go on Jamyang Leeds site, it's really clear where all the Mary's online teachings are that are being put on by the UK centres. So Mary, thank you. This will be winging its way to you. So thank you.
Thank you for making my few days meaningful, people. I hope to see you again soon.